Hi, this is Dan Melton. Thanks for joining us for this podcast of St. Andrew's Weekly Message. I hope you enjoy it. I encourage you to listen through the words to what God is saying to you, and may the peace of God be known through your life this week.
Thank you all. I'm so happy to be here with you. We need to get this over with. I'm going to ask you to do something that you are going to hate. And Presbyterians hate this worse than anybody because we are the frozen chosen and do not take kindly to change. But what I'm going to ask you to do is for everybody who is not already sitting in the first three rows of this section, please come in. Please come in and fill this in. And because I'm a guest, you have to do it because you have to be nice. So thank you all so much. Come on over. Normally I do this without microphones, but the fact of the matter is, if we tried to do it without mics, the folks at home would not be able to hear a single word. You have to do microphones in order to have the recording show up. So come on over, guys. This will be more fun. I'm not going to preach a sermon this morning, so this hopefully will counterbalance what I just asked you to do, which I know is not comfortable. I'm going to tell a story, but the reason I wanted everybody to come in close is I want it to be cozy and intimate. You know, if you're sitting around a campfire and half the people that are there are scattered across the field, it's just not, it just doesn't feel right. So I appreciate you all coming in this morning. So let's start with Scripture. And since it's not a sermon, I want this Scripture to basically be just kind of a backdrop for what we're going to do this morning. And it's a story that I think all of you are familiar with. I hope you are. It's in the second chapter of John, the Gospel of John. And it's about Jesus turning water into wine. Start with the first verse, first 10 verses. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now, both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were set there six water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. And when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So, I need to know who I'm talking to, so I want you to take a look at this word and tell me, raise your hand if you pronounce this Appalachia. Appalachia. Okay? Raise your hand if you pronounce it Appalachia. What about the rest of you? You all have some alternative pronunciation that I've never heard before. So you pronounced it both.
I did.
Yeah, yeah. Are there folks that go back and forth? Okay. Actually, that's a very Maryland thing to do. I have learned in the last 10 years that Maryland's kind of a transitional state. both from the south to the north and from Appalachia, which is definitely south, to Appalachia, which is kind of from Pennsylvania on. So you'll hear anything. You'll hear all kinds of pronunciations of this mountain range here in Maryland, which at first threw me off a little bit because I grew up in Appalachia. And if you said Appalachia, that meant you were not from around here and were highly suspicious and probably an enemy. So I've learned better than that now and appreciate these last 10 years or so that I've spent in this transitional state. It's very interesting. A lot of things I love about Maryland. But anyway, like I said, I grew up in the Appalachians. I grew up in a little town about 80 miles southwest of Roanoke, Virginia. It's a town called Wytheville. If you're driving past it, you'll probably think it's Wytheville, but it's not. It's Wytheville. And it's definitely deep in the Appalachians, but it's east of the coal fields, so it's more of a farm community. And I grew up in a small town in that area. And my mama's people had been there since the late 1600s. So I have some roots in Wythe County. My dad grew up in Southside, Virginia, which is the area just south of Richmond. And he and his brothers came to Wytheville after World War II. When they got out of World War II, they came up there and started a business. And Dad just fell in love with Appalachia. He had never been around the mountains, but just absolutely fell in love with the culture, with the traditions, but especially with the people. Now, Dad was a banjo player, and he was before he got to the mountains, so he fit right in with that, and he taught me to play the banjo. But he took it upon himself that he was going to make sure that since I had the privilege of being born and raised in those mountains, that I was going to learn to appreciate them as well. So he taught me everything he learned and introduced me to every mountain character from way back in the hollers and hills that he would run into, and taught me to play the banjo. So we had it all going, and by the time I was about 16, I thought I was pretty well educated and appreciated my native culture. But I came home from high school, and Dad had come from work early, and he met me at home, and he said, Son, we have spent a lot of time learning about all the wonders of the Appalachian Mountains, and you've met some very interesting people. But there's one aspect of this that we have not touched on, and it is crucial. It is one of the most important parts of Appalachian culture. He said, we have never made moonshine. Now, you got to imagine being 16 years old, coming home from high school and having your dad say, hey, let's go make a little moonshine. He had bought me the cutest little 10-gallon still. And I mean, it was just looked just like the movies, had the copper coil coming out of the thing, and it was mine. It was my very own still that my dad had bought me. Now, he was a businessman from Southside, Virginia, and I was a teenager, and neither one of us knew a thing about making moonshine. But Dad had met this bootlegger that lived out in the way out in the edge of the county, and the bootlegger had told him how to make this stuff and said that when it came time to run in it, that he would help us, because we were just complete neophytes on all of this. So he gave us a recipe for the mash, and the mash is the liquid that you put together that you then put in the still to run the moonshine. And it's just corn and sugar and yeast and water. It's a pretty simple mix. And you just put it in this crock. We had this crock that is probably 5 gallons, and we put it in that and then covered it with cheesecloth and just left it alone, and it ferments over 2 or 3 weeks. Now, I don't know if y'all have ever smelled fermenting corn. It's basically rotting corn. It is horrible. If it had not been summertime, I don't think we could have stood it. But we had this mash going and had it getting ready, and finally, finally, after a couple of awful weeks with the windows open, we had it ready, and we called the moonshiner, and he said, "Great, come on out, and we'll run a little white light." So we put this big crock of mash in the back of the car, and Dad and I got in there and headed off to the moonshiner's cabin. And we started off on just regular state roads with, you know, painted lines on them. And then they became just regular hardtop roads. And then we turned left onto this gravel road that was heading out into the country. And that gravel road became a dirt road going up over hollers and hills that I'd never even seen before, even though they were still in my home county. And finally, that dirt road just kind of petered out into two ruts running through the woods, and then the sawgrass was scraping up under the car, and the branches were scraping the sides of the car, and then that gave out into a creek, and we drove through the creek into the moonshiner's yard and turned off the engine. And the minute that we turned off the engine, every breed of dog that existed came pouring out of that moonshiner's cabin and was up on our cars and barking and growling and jumping all over the place. And then the moonshiner himself stepped out, and he was probably in his 40s, but he looked at his 60s. He was rough and lean, and his steely eyes were just glaring out from under his old greasy ball cap. And he was very, very skinny, and he had his overalls just kind of hanging on his lank body, and had these great big Brogan work boots. Literally, he just looked like a caricature of a hillbilly, looked like a cartoon of one. And he was looking down on us, looking hard as he could. But then he recognized us, and his whole face lit up, and he called all the dogs off so we could get out of the car, and he said, "Get that mash and follow me." And so we went around behind his cabin and started up the mountainside. And I was carrying that mash, and we were going along, and we were, to our left was this huge patch of mountain laurel. Now, have any of y'all been around mountain laurel? Okay, I used to hunt in it, and there were times that I had to literally get down on my hands and knees to crawl through it because it is so thick and tangled. And this was a huge patch. You couldn't even see the end of it. Huge patch of mountain laurel. And we were walking up the mountain beside it, and all of a sudden the moonshiner just turned and disappeared into that laurel patch. And I was like, how in the world am I going to carry this crock of mash through that laurel? But when I got up to the place where he had disappeared, I saw that if you moved a few branches, there was a little path that kind of went into the laurel. It was ingeniously hidden. Nobody ever would have seen it unless you knew exactly where it was. So I followed the moonshiner in, and that path weaved about 100 yards back through that laurel patch, like a labyrinth. I mean, it was all over the place, weaving back and forth. And finally, it opened up into the most beautiful little meadow I have ever seen in my life. Couldn't have been more than 50 yards across. And it was surrounded on one side by that laurel patch and on the other side by old growth oak trees. And it had a little stream running through the edge of it. It was absolutely just otherworldly. But the most beautiful part of it all was right in the center of that meadow, of that pretty little grassy meadow, was a fire ring made of rocks, and it had a little rock shelf, and on that rock shelf sat my still, my little 10-gallon still. I was so proud. And so the moonshiner, he got the fire ready to go, and we poured the mash into the still and put the cap and the coil back on the top of it. And I always feel like at least part of a Sunday morning service ought to be educational. So I'd like to tell you all, in case you don't know, tell you all a little bit about how to make moonshine. That's the educational part of this service. It's not hard. It's pretty simple. Y'all can be taking notes. That's okay. It's pretty simple. You put that mash in there, and it's fermented, and if you you have to keep the fire just right, but you keep the fire at a certain temperature, and because alcohol will boil and turn to steam at a lower temperature than water, it will rise up. If you don't get the fire too hot, it'll rise up separate from the water and go up to the top of the still, and then as it concentrates there, it'll condense as it comes down that little copper coil, and then your jug or your mason jar or whatever you got at the end of the coil, you set it under there and it drips out into it. So it's a fairly simple process. But like so many things in the mountains, even though it's simple, it's an art to do it well. It really is. And I can tell you firsthand that moonshine made as well as it can be by a true artist is better than anything you can buy in the liquor store. It has a reputation of being rot gut, but it's not. It's very, very high quality. Now, if you make it wrong, it can kill you. So you've got to have somebody that knows what they're doing, and that's why we had the moonshiner there helping us. So we were sitting there, and again, just imagine being 16 years old, sitting there with your dad and the moonshiner, you know, a man among men, and the evening was setting in, and the crickets were chirping, and you know, off in the woods, the whippoorwills were starting to sing, and we were just sitting there and telling stories and laughing and letting that moonshine do what it does. And then all of a sudden we heard the sharp crack of a stick breaking with somebody stepping on it, and we got deadly silent and deadly still. And as we were listening, we heard footsteps coming down that path through the laurel. Now, I don't think I have to remind you that what we were doing was highly illegal, okay? So if that was a deputy sheriff or the federal revenue were coming down that path, we were in trouble. It was getting dark. The woods were black as a cave. There was nowhere to go, nowhere to run. And this was a serious situation. My dad could lose his business. The moonshiner could go to jail. I could forget about going to college and having any kind of a future if this was the law coming through that laurel patch. And I truly understood how serious it was when I saw the moonshiner reach inside his bib of his overalls and just kind of lay his hand there just in case he had to draw and fire. I knew how serious this was. So we just sat there, dead silent, listening to those footsteps get closer and closer. And then all of a sudden, we breathed a big sigh of relief because it was the moonshiner's wife that stepped out into that little meadow. And she had brought her guitar, and Dad had asked me to bring my banjo. And so she started playing these old mountain songs. Those old, old songs that came from over in Scotland and Ireland, those old murder ballads and courting songs. And she sung with such a pure mountain voice. It would just made the whole scene timeless. And then she changed keys. And she started singing another song, and it was kind of soft at first, but it grew louder and bolder as she went on. And she sang, "One glad morning, when this life is over, God's celestial shore, oh, I'll fly away." Sing it with me. I'll fly away, oh Gloria. Fly away in the morning when I die. Hallelujah, by and by, oh, I'll fly away. You know, as those last notes echoed off into the dark woods, everything had changed. I realized everything had changed. With that simple mountain gospel song, that good, humble woman had invited Jesus into our somewhat nefarious situation. And you know, she invited him, and he came, and he took it for his own. He absolutely took it for his own. And what I remember, we went ahead, we finished the moonshine. We finished making it. It was awful. Oh, my Lord. I don't know what we did. We must have messed up the mash somewhere along the way. But when I look back over the decades and I remember that night, that very special night, it's not all the daring and excitement and danger of running a little white lightning that I remember. What I really, truly remember is the miraculous way that Jesus Christ came in to that, albeit sinful, situation, and he transformed it into something that bordered on a spiritual experience. And I believe he'll do that for each of us. I do believe that if we ask him, he'll do that. He will take the ordinary water of our mundane and sometimes aggravating lives, day-to-day lives, and he will transform them into the very wine of heaven. All we have to do is ask. Thank you all.